The AIDS pandemic has raged for more than a quarter century. Currently, over 40 million people around the world are infected with the HIV virus, and that number continues to grow each year by a million or more. Although there are treatments to help manage the disease, they are not always accessible to every infected person, and there's still no cure. In 1987, this radio program looked at the AIDS crisis in a five-part series just as the destruction wrought by the virus was reaching a horrifying level here in New York City. Today, we begin a new five-part series on the topic called AIDS Then and Now. The first installment will look at how far we've come and how far we have to go before a cure is developed. And joining us are two of the most important doctors in the field, Drs. Robert Gallo and Jay Levy. Both of them are distinguished scientists who played key roles in discovering HIV, and their work continues to push the front lines of research closer to a cure. It is my great honor to welcome both of them to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Let's begin by hearing how many researchers assessed the AIDS crisis on the show in 1987. This is Dr. Sam Waxel, who was then the CEO of ImClone, who was working to develop an HIV vaccine.
Because we're dealing with a disease in this case, which thus far hasn't shown any individual that's surviving really with the disease over the long term.
So we've come a long way, Dr. Gallo, since 1987 with the development of numerous therapies for HIV/AIDS. But don't we still have a long way to go?
Well, a long way is bringing therapy to everyone, in which programs like the PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief, are trying to do and have made a dramatic difference. Our institute is heavily involved in these programs, as are several other universities working with people on the ground in Africa and some other places like Vietnam, Guyana, Haiti. So, you know, I think therapy is really quite effective, amazing in many respects, and historical in other respects. But as you pointed out in the intro, we need to bring it to everyone, and that's a tremendous problem, difficult, expensive, and because it's needed for the lifetime of the person, it makes it even a greater difficulty. Yet it's a major change in that this is beginning to happen. And obviously, we would love to see the development of an effective HIV preventive vaccine to get rid of this once and for all. And there are different scientists will have different views on the prospects and probabilities. My personal view for the last 5 years is that for the first time we can kind of see a pathway to an effective preventive vaccine. But without any doubt, this takes a long time for multiple reasons, including the model, animal model we deal with, monkeys, and is fraught with difficulties. But I really mean it when I say we can see reasonable possibilities, but it's hard to make predictions. So in the absence of that vaccine, but the presence of good drugs, the current extreme difficulty in trying to reach a cure, as you put it, so the drugs are required forevermore in the lifetime of the patient, we have to continue to seek new and improved methods of therapy that are less expensive, and that if the patient has evolved escape mutants from the current drugs, that we have new approaches to therapy. And there are people that are trying to use therapy to diminish the epidemic by lowering the amount of virus, an exceedingly difficult task also, and costly, and requiring extensive and continued diagnostic testing with the blood test.
Well, several of the guests on this program in 1987 were working on a vaccine. Again, let's listen to how Dr. Waxel assessed the chances of a vaccine then.
It will be years before we know whether or not we have an effective vaccine against this disease. And I think that I'm speaking about many years, more than a decade.
Well, the assessment of more than a decade, Dr. Levy, now seems rather optimistic, considering that it's been 23 years since he said that. Why has it been so difficult to create a functioning vaccine for HIV?
Well, I want to point out to the listeners, this virus is very different from any other that for which we have a vaccine. One of the important points is that when it infects a cell, it's able to put its genetic material in p- put it inside the chromosome of the cell. So now you've got an infected cell, which I often compare to like a cancer cell, and it can remain and continue to produce viruses. Now that cell is also present in genital fluids, so it can be passed to individuals, and unless you can get rid of that infected cell, it can release virus that will be transmitted. So that's one problem. The second problem, which people often talk about, is the fact that this virus has abilities to mutate very readily. It's been estimated that each time it replicates, there's up to 10 mutations, although most of them, the viruses will not survive very well. The ones that survive can be totally changed.
So
you need to be able to have a virus, have a vaccine that will hit all those type viruses.
Are we dealing with different strains or types of this HIV virus today than we were in the 1980s?
Well, it's fascinating to see from the 1980s the comments. We knew then that there were two major types, HIV-1 and HIV-2. What we didn't know was that, at least with the HIV-1, it can come in what might say several different flavors, types, which we call subtypes or clades. And we may have thought there were three or four. There are up to at least nine now. And the other complications that concur is that they can interact among themselves and form what we call recombinants, essentially have genetic material of one of the clades mixed with genetic material of another clade. But essentially what we're after is a vaccine that will recognize all these viruses. I think it's possible, but 10 years, I think, was extremely optimistic, and it is certainly, I think, optimistic now.
It was interesting that you made the cancer analogy, because I can't remember how many years ago it was that was it President Nixon said that we would beat cancer in 25 years? It's obviously going to take a lot longer. But Dr. Gallo, have researchers pretty much unlocked most of the secrets of HIV/AIDS?
Well, no one would ever answer that with a quick yes, I think. The progress in understanding the basic biology of HIV has really been quite terrific. So you could say there's a tremendous amount that we understand. There's no doubt about that. But once you become confident that you really understand so much about HIV, there's another observation in the field that opens up more doorways and, in a sense, more headaches. I couldn't really give a percentage of, you know. And by the way, I mean, sometimes you can have complete knowledge of something and not be able to solve it. But better that you have as much knowledge as possible, obviously.
Well, what are some of the headaches that are currently dealing with?
Well, Jay Levy, I agree with everything he said. I mean, he's mentioned the major ones. But when I say, so let's not talk about new ones, but the great variation of the virus, but he mentioned as number one, and I totally agree, is this fact that the viral genes are integrated into our chromosomal DNA upon infection. I mean, within a few days, it's established infection. An analogy, let's say, in talking about vaccine, look at polio. We're vaccinated, but if we are exposed to heavy amounts of polio, let's say you drink a vial or so, you're going to get an early infection, very likely. But there's time for the immune system to gather itself and to eliminate the polio virus before it gets from our gastrointestinal tract into our brain and spinal cord, and so you don't get polio. But with HIV, that's not the case. Within a few days or a day, you've established infection. Immune response, if it's not there already and sustained from a vaccine that's ready and present all the time and not decaying, you're going to get infected. And that infection becomes permanent in many cases, maybe most cases. So once the genes are integrated and the immune response comes, well, it's too late. Virus is there. So if I made a vaccine tomorrow that I put out on the market, you'd want to say, well, does it stop the virus right at the gate? Does it prevent the virus getting into the cell or destroy the cell soon after infection, very soon after infection? If so, does it do it at the mucosal sites where the infections occur, like the urethra or the rectum or the vagina, et cetera, or blood? Is it there? And does it last for a long time? so you don't have to boost the immune response every 3 or 4 months, which would be impractical, for example, be impractical anywhere, but certainly in some parts of the world, virtually impossible. And for whatever reason, the immune response to HIV, a very important protein that you're targeting in a vaccine, is what we call the envelope protein, this outer protein that is looking for the cell as the virus approaches the cell. And that protein is not only hypermutable, that is very variable, but when you make an immune response to it, for reasons no one on earth that I know of understands, it's short-lived, 3 to 4 months maximum, for good effective antibodies that are the kind you want against that protein. So those are problems that we face as examples.
I'm talking with Dr. Robert Gallo, Director of the Institute of Human Virology and Division of Basic Science at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and Dr. J.A. Levy, Director of the Laboratory for Tumor and AIDS Virus Research at the University of California, San Francisco. Do we have any idea why the body only defends itself against HIV for a very short time, and what does the body do, Dr. Levy?
Well, I want to follow up with what Bob said, because there is some positive news, and he and I, we were recognized that there are some people out there who have been exposed many times to HIV, and they aren't infected. Now, the important point is that they seem to have an immune response, which we call a natural immune response, which may not be detected because it's not antibodies that you can measure in the test tube or cells that are known to kill infected cells. These are a different type of immune system, we've known about it, which is a natural response which occurs very quickly, within minutes to hours. And in these people, we predict they have a very robust innate immune response that protects them. The important point is, in some of the studies we've done, is that if these people, for instance, let's say wives of hemophiliacs who at the point didn't know their husband was infected, or that they just continue to have sexual contact without using condoms or something, several of them did not get infected, and we found innate immune responses with them, and then after a year it disappeared if they hadn't had continual contact. I think the same thing was seen with prostitutes in Nairobi, where when they left the profession and came, they were, let's say, exposed, about 10% of them exposed the same number of partners. They never got infected. This is work from Frank Plummer's group. And then when they left the profession and came back 2 years later, several of them got infected. And we interpret this as saying that they had lost this natural immune response. It's somewhat what Bob's talking about. There wasn't a memory. And if we're going to make a vaccine, it's got to have a memory. And so what we're trying to do, and I think the field is moving, is to get a vaccine that will enhance the natural immunity that can occur, and that will then lead to a second type of acquired immunity, which has a memory. And this is very difficult, as is obvious, in terms of finding an effective HIV vaccine.
Well, we'll be talking about vaccines and also about the controversial research of Dr. Jiro Huter after we take a little break here. My guests are Dr. J.A. Levy of the University of California, San Francisco, and Dr. Robert C. Gallo of the University of Maryland. This is WNYC. Later on in this hour, award-winning biographer Lyndall Gordon reveals an unfamiliar side of Emily Dickinson. Plus, this week's Please Explain is all about batteries and how they power everything from your flashlight to your car. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Welcome back to the first of a new five-part series on the subject of HIV/AIDS. We are looking back at a series that we did in 1987 and seeing how far we have come. Our new series is AIDS Then and Now, and our guests are Dr. Robert C. Gallo, Director of the Institute of Human Virology and Division of Basic Science at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and Dr. J. A. Levy, Director of the Laboratory for Tumor and AIDS Virus Research at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Gallo, I understand that your group is working on an HIV vaccine. How is the vaccine you're working on different from previous attempts?
Oh, boy, this is a little complicated, but let me do my best. It is a vaccine that targets the outer protein that attempts to induce antibodies to this outer protein called the envelope. That certainly was done at the very beginning of the field, but most people in the field knew it wouldn't work, even though a clinical trial went forward, actually from West Coast company. And it was predictable failure, actually, to a significant degree, because in animal models, using this envelope protein would induce immunity, but only to the very virus you used to make the vaccine. We call it type-specific immunity. So it didn't cover the variants of HIV, the extensive variants of HIV.
But let me stop you for a moment. The reason you were going after the outer envelope is because you were trying to stop the whole process,
exactly.
Going after one portion of the virus rather than trying to kill the whole thing?
Yeah, there's not an easy mechanism to just go forward and try to kill the whole thing. I mean, you target something with a vaccine. And usually, in the past, most vaccines were made using an attenuated, a modified live, so to speak, virus. And that's way too dangerous with HIV, and of course, never.
Because you'll be infecting people.
Yeah, with a variant of the virus that you assume wouldn't cause AIDS, but usually does, no matter what lesions we tend to put in the virus. If it's active and replicating, what you have left is very dangerous, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't use, like in polio, the Sabin vaccine was a live attenuated polio. It means polio that you didn't think would cause polio, rarely would, but was a very good vaccine for the majority of people. You do that with HIV, it really is hard to cripple it, still have it replicate, you know, still have it, quote, live. It'll cause disease. So then you can use a killed virus. That means take the whole virus and kill it, Jonas Salk, polio. Well, that doesn't work with HIV. All the testing of that showed it was very poorly immunogenic, and FDA thought still too dangerous because you might not kill all of it. So we were left with what are called subunit vaccines, namely take a protein, take a gene that makes a protein, et cetera, et cetera. Either give the protein as such or use a vector, a carrier, an innocuous other kind of virus to carry it into the cell. So we focus on the protein that's the outer protein, the envelope, because that's the protein that starts the infectious process. That protein, the envelope, is looking for its site on the cell to link to bind to initiate the first stage of infection, penetration of the cell membrane, entry of the viral genetic information into the cell. So we think we need to block it at that stage. So that was obvious back at the beginning that we should target the envelope.
Will that help you deal with the memory problem that Dr. Levy was talking about?
That is a two-part story, and let me come to it quickly as I can, okay? If you're targeting the envelope, I said what the first vaccine that went forward was type specific. It only worked against the viruses of the exact type that you used to get the envelope from. So it wouldn't work against the majority of HIVs. So how is our approach different? We're looking for sequences, that is, regions of the envelope that cannot change. Because in order to do its job, some regions have to be conserved and not mutate, not change. And we're looking for those regions that are non-mutable that are also functionally required for the virus to begin the infection process. We have focused on such regions that are normally protected by complex mechanisms against an attack by antibodies. But we worked on a method that exposes that you make your vaccine that will make antibodies that will work when these regions are exposed. And in animal primate experiments, I would just like to leave it at this, we have interesting results. I don't want to make any prediction about the interesting results. We have a large collaboration with the Gates Foundation, and we're trying to move this forward into the very beginning of clinical testing for safety. It's interesting results in animals, and that's what we can say. Now, what my colleague Jay was talking about and I were talking about before, there are two parts to that story. Jay was talking, Dr. Levy was talking about innate immune system, where you have not an antibody memory response, but just something that occurs rapidly. Like, for example, you have blood cells that swallow bacteria, that work immediately. They don't need have a memory. They don't need a memory. Years ago, in the mid-80s, Dr. Levy described an unidentified set of factors, proteins that come out, that are released by cells that can fight HIV infection. Some of those proteins that he had alluded to, we identified as molecules that in 1995 we published could block HIV infection. Now, that's part of the innate immune system. That's part of what Dr. Levy was talking about. But we don't have any memory for those molecules. We don't know how to make a vaccine that could induce them. They're there more in some people than in others, and it requires continued exposure, like a prostitute that he was talking about, continuing to have the sexual contacts and stimulating the innate immunity. But what I was referring to is antibody response to the envelope protein that we induce with our vaccine, or anybody would induce with any vaccine that targets the envelope. That has memory. But when you make those antibodies, we don't know why. They're short-lived. I have antibodies against measles. They generally last a whole lifetime when you get exposed to a measles vaccine. They last for years and years. But antibodies, memory antibodies, to the envelope of HIV are only around for 3 or 4 months, and they fade out. We don't know why. And we're trying to work on mechanisms to maintain those antibodies for our vaccine to have a chance.
We're talking with Dr. Robert C. Gallo at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and Dr. J. A. Levy of the University of California, San Francisco, about AIDS then and now. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you want to add to that, Dr. Levy, or should I move on to the work of Dr. Gero Huettner?
What Bob's seeing as well and talked about with antibodies, it does suggest that you're going to need booster shots like we need for hepatitis B. And that's not so bad, except if you think about trying to get this internationally and go into communities where it's bad enough to give one shot that you'd have to come back and give a few shots. So you really need a new idea, novel approach that would allow the memory to stay. Also, Bob was talking about one part of that memory, which is the antibodies, and the other part are actual cells of the immune system that can recognize the virus and actually recognize the infected cell. So now we're back to that real culprit, the infected cell, where if you had an immune system that once the infection took place, it would say, all right, I recognize that infected cell. I'm going to take care of it as well. That would be fantastic. And the only vaccine that's given some promise, which is the one that was done in Thailand, combined the antibody response with a cellular response. Some of us feel it's the starting point to go towards a vaccine. I would add in that we really need to see, was there also a very robust innate or natural immune response that came first, which allowed then the acquired or the secondary, more memory responses to take place.
I'm assuming that because the vast majority of HIV patients and new infections are in poorer countries, a vaccine not only has to be effective, and you have to convince people to take more than one shot, take booster shots, but you also have to make it affordable.
Absolutely. Now, and we have to assume that the world community will come forward, and most of us feel they will.
Now, what is this about the tests that were done in Thailand?
They immunized the vaccine, and consisted of what Bob was talking about in terms of using a different virus that would replicate a little bit in the person and present proteins that were part of HIV. and then follow that with what we call, it's called a prime boost, but essentially you then boost them a month or two later, and maybe they got several of these, in which you got the envelope protein, which is what Bob is working on. So there they had 30% of the people were protected from infection. That has to be repeated, but it certainly was the first bit of encouraging news.
Although 30% is just one-third. That means two-thirds of the people were not protected from infection.
Absolutely, and there are many questions about that vaccine trial that needs to be answered.
What about stem cell and gene therapies? Are they likely to be promising in HIV-AIDS research, or have they turned out to be a dead end?
Well, as you mentioned, Gerhard Hüther had an article in the New England Journal of Medicine last year, which I thought was very clever. Essentially, he had a patient with leukemia, and he had to do a bone marrow stem cell transplant. Now, let's go back a bit and say that HIV, when it infects a cell, has to attach to two different receptors generally. I mean, one that's one part of an attachment, and then a secondary attachment site. And unless it does both, it can't enter. And the most dominant one is what we call CCR5. And that is on most people. There are about 1% of people of Western background or Caucasian background, who 1% who do not have this protein, and they are perfectly healthy, at least from what we can see. There is no harm in eliminating that protein from their genes. But so what Hüther did was to, instead of taking a match for a bone marrow of someone that just was able to be received by the one with the leukemia, he found someone as a donor who was a good match to give the stem cell transplant, but also lacked this attachment site, CCR5. Now, he did this. He did have to do it twice, and he was just in our city 2 weeks ago. The patient is now 3 years out. There is no leukemia, and there's no detectable virus in his blood. So it is extremely encouraging. We don't know over time what will happen, but he's off all therapy. So you're really seeing a very promising approach if one could direct a stem cell method where you could take out stem cells, manipulate them so they don't make CCR5, and then put them back into the person who's got the virus.
Has anyone tried to replicate this?
I think he is trying to do it. It's very tough to find a donor who lacks CCR5 and also is a good match. And so some of the things we're doing actually here with YWCON in the Institute is to see if we can manipulate stem cells to lack CCR5 from people who are HIV infected. Then you could imagine you could take those out. They would be a natural match because it comes right from that person. You would then put the stem cells in with the capability of repopulating the body with the immune system, and they would be protected against HIV infection. I think there are two or three groups that I know of that are trying this. I think it's very, very possible and a promising approach.
Dr. Gallo, what's your thought on this?
Well, yeah, I don't think there's proof of any so-called cure. You'd have to wait until the patient died, and you'd have to look at viral sequences and all the tissue of the body. Yeah. So, I think it's a presumption to say the patient is cured of HIV.
Yeah, they usually use the word functionally cured.
Yeah, functionally cured. Well,
yeah,
maybe
right.
They just use what everybody else would say. It's just no detectable virus.
Right. Well, how many people have this immunity?
The lack of CCR5. By the way, that's the target. For those molecules, I told you in following up on Jay's work that we found an innate immune response to. They bind to that CCR5 and cause it to, so to speak, disappear. It causes the internalization of the receptor CCR5, which HIV uses to enter a cell. So, you can either have no CCR5 or high beta chemokines. These molecules are called beta chemokines. And the result is the same. You block HIV from getting into the cell. But as Jay was saying, a certain percentage of people are born without CCR5, but that's rare. So you really, on a practical level, you can't extend this, and you certainly can't do it in, let's say, Africa. However, what Jay was then explaining is that there may be ways of going into the laboratory and taking somebody's stem cells and manipulating them so they don't have CCR5, and then transferring those cells to a person, to the same person back. That still would not be doable in a wide scale in a place like Africa where the epidemic is huge. But on individuals who could afford it, in theory, you wouldn't have to go out and look for the rare genetic variant who doesn't have CCR5. I gather what Jay's trying to do with Dr. Khan is manipulate the very patient's own stem cells and try to see if you could, in the laboratory, in the culture, get rid of CCR5, cut it out, so to speak, and then give him back his own stem cell.
That's right.
Yeah, and that is an interesting, even somewhat exciting idea, if doable. But difficult to transpose to Africa. In other words, I think we still have an HIV epidemic. I mean, so for me, we've got to get a vaccine. And I agree with everything that was said by Jane, that in terms of the vaccine, we have to get this to last longer, solve that problem. You can't be going over to Africa and boosting every 3 or 4 months. We're keenly aware of that.
Just one more thing, because we're pretty much out of time. You mentioned the Gates Foundation support. What about the federal government? Have we seen a strong support from the Bush administration, from the Obama administration?
Well, I mean, AIDS research is, I think, after the first few years, I jumped to comment the first one that you get is the last second. I'll try to be as brief as possible. I think, you know, it was exaggerated that there wasn't support. There wasn't in the very early years, but we've had reasonable support all along. In the Bush administration, started PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief for Africa. This was it's the most enormous support in the history of public health for anything. You know, it's up to $60 billion. You know, this is really a tremendous amount of support. Now, for research, no scientist is going to say there's enough. And the easiest way to put it is that no money, never. In progress, and some money later, and good money sooner. But it's so, you know, of course, there has been times when the funding has slipped, the young investigators were being deprived. But overall, as a field, I can't say it's one of the worst off. So that would be my comment.
Yeah, I would just mention that the stimulus package from the Obama administration has been very helpful. But essentially, all of the research, not only AIDS, but all types of research, has been compromised by the economy. And it's almost, if people would like to know, I mean, you're getting maybe only 8 grants out of 100 funded by the federal government. So this compares to 15 or 20 when we had enough funding for everyone that applied. So Bob's right, and there's never enough money, but I think right now the federal government's doing the best they can, but there really needs to be more funds.
Just one more thing. 23 years ago, we were told it would take a little more than a decade. Obviously, that didn't pan out. Is anybody making any predictions today?
For what?
When we're going to have something, a vaccine that that might affect something that could look like a cure or at least prevent someone from getting AIDS.
Yeah, August 14th at 7 o'clock in the morning. Jesus, no.
Alas.
We're not gonna say.
Well, let me say, this is June 18th. Bring us back in 10 years, and we'll be thrilled to be here. And I think we will have at least a better vaccine than the Thai vaccine.
Okay, it's a date.
Going forward.
It's a day.
Okay.
Dr. J. A. Levy, Director of the Laboratory for Tumor and AIDS Virus Research at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Robert C. Gallo, Director of the Institute of Human Virology and Division of Basic Science at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Thank you so much for participating in today's, the first in a 5-part series called AIDS Then and Now.
We'll be right back.
Up next, Linda Gordon explains why she thinks that epilepsy was the reason behind Emily Dickinson's famed seclusion. I wanted to let you know that jazz pianist Jason Moran and Grammy-winning vocalist Bobby McFerrin will perform in the Green Space this Monday, and you can be in the audience. For tickets to a live broadcast of Soundcheck, go to WNYC.org/Greenspace. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.